Welcome to the Cinematologist Podcast. I'm Neil Fox. It's really nice to be back with you, and I hope you're all doing as well as you can in these crazy, troubling, weird, stressful times. I hope you're finding some time for yourself, some time for movies, and yeah, feeling the joyous, kind of cathartic wonder of cinema wherever you can grab it. And it's really nice to be back after a bit of a break of a few weeks, couple of weeks, not sure. Time is a weird concept most of the time, sadly right now. This is the fourth episode of the season, and it's interesting because I did two in February as planned, and then had two sort of planned for March, but only managed to get one episode out. So this is the fourth episode, and I was hoping it'd be the fifth, but then, yeah, just March was a busy month and a weird month, and some things didn't come off, and I always miss Dario when doing the podcast. Like, it's enjoyable doing it on my own, and I'm feeling very good about the season as it's coming together, but there's always a bit missing when doing these episodes, and that's Dario. I kind of felt it even more keenly in March when became quite stressed about not being able to get another episode out. Just had the one that came off and, you know, kind of realized that there's so much support that automatically comes from collaboration where, you know, I only have to do normally one a month and Dario will do another one. And then if we do any more, then that's great. But, you know, normally my responsibility is to sort of direct one episode a month, and really missed having Dario and his contribution in that episode, but also just in terms of the podcast in the month. So yeah, another reminder of how invaluable he is to this, if it wasn't already obvious that it's a very different proposition when it's just me. So I miss you, Dario. I mean, I talk to you a lot. It's not like I don't talk to you, but miss you in this context. And yeah, hopefully everyone is okay with the fact that there was only one in March. But I do feel like, again, at this point, our audience is our audience, and you know that it'll be worth the wait when we eventually get there. So hopefully today's episode is worth the wait. So today's episode is an interview with Rachel Lambert, who's the director of a new feature film called Sometimes I Think About Dying, which is in cinemas this weekend, starring Daisy Ridley, who is also a producer on the film. We get a lot of requests to watch films and talk about films and interview people on the podcast, which is really nice. And we often can't respond because there's not enough notice, or we've already got episodes lined up, or we just don't think it's necessarily going to be a good fit. But when the request came through to review and sort of have some interview time for this film, I was really excited because I've been wanting to see the film since I saw it on festival bills, because as I sort of mentioned in the episode, it comes from a short film. It comes from a play originally, but it also comes from a short film, which I use in my teaching every year. I use it in short film screenwriting. I think it's a really beautiful short, and I really love the short film. So I was really excited to see a feature that kind of addressed the same story and same ideas as the short, and then to kind of discuss the relationship between the two. And there's a little coda from me after today's interview talking about that specifically, because I don't want to go into it too much beforehand. And the interview, I think, itself is quite revealing about that aspect, and I'll touch on that in the coda. But that was what kind of drove me to talk to Rachel in terms of just wanting to see the film. And then when I saw the film, I really loved the film. I think it's pretty evident in the conversation that I really loved it. And yeah, I'm excited for people to see. I think it's a very different kind of performance from Daisy Ridley. And yeah, just a really, really wonderful indie movie. In the interview, I mentioned Kelly Reichardt because the film is set in the Pacific Northwest, and sort of talking about how oftentimes one film or one filmmaker is synonymous with a place. As I mentioned here before, that's something of a kind of current preoccupation in terms of British cinema and its kind of single flagship filmmakers or films from cities or regions of the UK. But after the interview, I watched or rewatched Aaron Katz's Cold Weather, which is a wonderful kind of mystery indie mumblecore movie from, I think it's like 2010 or 2011, which I'd seen before. And that's set in the Pacific Northwest as well, around Portland. And it's another really interesting evocation of the place that kind of, yeah, is not like Kelly Reichardt. It's not like Sometimes I Think About Dying. It's a different thing. It does similar things with kind of being in conversation with different genres. In that case, the kind of the pulpy mystery, sort of missing woman, noirish elements, but it's also very much a kind of low-key indie drama, and it uses both of its kind of aesthetic ideas really, really well. But it's interesting to see another representation of that place on screen in the interim. So that was nice to spend a bit of time in the Pacific Northwest cinematically alongside the time I spent with Sometimes I Think About Dying, and also watching Kelly Reichardt showing up finally recently with its digital release, which is, as always, a wonderful time. So I do want to thank Rachel for her time talking to me for the podcast. I had a really, really lovely time. It was nice to hear at the start before we taped, and then you sort of hear it right at the end, that Rachel had engaged with the podcast and sort of enjoyed the conversation as well. And it's always nice to know that, you know, that when people listen to what we do, they feel like it's a bit different, and it's, you know, it's going to be about cinema, and it's going to be about film and sort of filmmaking. And that was really, really nice to hear. So I'm really grateful to her for listening to the podcast and kind of coming to the conversation, you know, on the terms of the show, which is always really, really nice. And I had a really great time. And before we taped, she said that, you know, everyone that we have on is really, really intelligent. It's a bit daunting, but I think it was a really great conversation. Rachel is a really smart, intelligent filmmaker, and the film is smart, intelligent, and really cinematic. And I hope that people spend some time with it on its release in the next couple of weeks. And hopefully in some way, this might help just encourage one or two people, maybe more, to seek it out. So let's go to the interview now. I'll be back straight afterwards with a little coda before we say goodbye. But for now, this is me talking to the director of Sometimes I Think About Dying, Rachel Lambert.
Introduce you all to the newest member of our little family. This is Robert.
Hello. Hey, Fran, right?
Hey, Fran. Sorry.
I scared you. I'm sneaking up on people. Booga booga.
Remember the.
We call this our coffee. Espresso.
You're funny.
Do you have plans tonight?
So did you like the movie?
I didn't really like anything about the movie.
What do you like?
My job.
What about it?
I'm good at it. Tell me something about you.
Got divorced. I guess I can't seem to figure it out.
Figure one out?
Love. Considering if one should die or if one should. You're secretly good at a lot of things. You just don't let anyone know. And I found me on the road to Genoa. I like you. I want to get to know you. But you just won't let me. And I don't know what to do. It's confusing.
What do you want from me?
Why is it so hard with you?
Do you wish you could unknow me?
It's hard, isn't it? Being a person. I did what I could.
All was good. Welcome to the show, Rachel. Hello.
Hello.
Thank you so much for joining me. I'm really excited to talk to you. I really enjoyed the film. Like I really liked it. It's been on my radar for a while because I love the short film, and I use the short film every year in teaching when I teach short film screenwriting.
Oh, the writers and the filmmaker will love hearing that.
Hmm. So I just think it's a wonderful short. And one of the things I love about the feature is that it speaks to the short in ways that hopefully we'll get to. But I just wondered, when did you come on board the project in terms of, was it a feature script already, or were you involved in the development from the short forwards?
I was sent the feature script by my producer, Alex Sachs, and it had been shared with her by the screenwriter, Kevin Armento, through a mutual friend of ours named Corey Finlay, who's a filmmaker. And so Alex had gotten it. She really liked it. She's always kind of, when she shares things with me, she doesn't put her cards on the table. She always wants to have like a clean reaction from me. So she just forwards things along, you know, says, tell me what you think. I never really know why she's sharing this with me. What's her feelings about it? I like that she does that. I read it. I loved it. I think I said something like, I became very aggressive immediately about wanting to direct it. And I think I said some aggressive language about anyone else who tried to direct it. And she quickly calmed me down. I got like real Kentucky real fast. She was like, no need. You know, and indicated, yeah, I'm really interested in this script. I'm really excited to hear that you are too. She had thought of me for it. And then our very first conversation, I think that very one when I said I wanted to do it, obviously whoever plays Fran matters so much.
Because
film, me anyway, how I interpreted the script that they wrote was that it needed to be a first person narrative on screen. And so we would be living inside that character the way that I wanted to make it. So I suggested Daisy Ridley in our first conversation, and my heart was real set on her saying yes. So when she did say yes so quickly, I think within days of us sending it to her, that really expedited our momentum and into making it. But yes, yeah, so it was a kind of almost boring traditional steps, you know. Producer sends me script. I say I like. I say this is who I want to do it with. She says I like, and then we go get money, and then we make.
It sounds so easy. Why doesn't everybody just do that?
I feel so bad when I tell the story, because this is an anomaly not only in my filmmaking career, but I think in most filmmaking narratives, this is not the way it normally goes. So I don't mean to like promote a false idea to those out there looking to make films maybe for the first time. I'm like, This is not normal. We were just very fortunate. I think, you know, I got the script at the end of 2020. So we were only just starting to imagine coming out of lockdowns and COVID and making films again. So the pipeline was kind of unclogged. And I think that had a lot to do with the speed.
Yeah. Yeah. And obviously, I guess that Daisy's reaction was obviously incredibly strong, because she came on board as a producer. So she was obviously invested from day one, not just in playing the role, but in the film as a project that would get made, I guess.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, she was very, very desirous of it getting made, and she was very I think that I don't want to speak for her, but I got the impression that she hadn't been invited in. Sorry, that's New York out there. She hadn't been invited in like that from producers and teammates, and as a result, she's out making her own projects these days, and had a film premiere at South by Southwest that she conceived of and produced. And I'm so glad that this experience sort of lit a fire.
Amazing. What was it in the script that drew you to the project? Because I think one of the things that's in the feature is there's so many points of entry thematically in terms of what you're able to observe and sort of capture. But what was it for you that you were like, this is the thing I need to that makes me want to make this?
Well, I think there was a lot of points of entry for me in the read. Them being playwrights, they wrote something that was so kind of gloriously inviting in terms of its spareness. You know, they weren't prescribing things to me as writers. They were writing it the way I think playwrights, they have a lot of confidence and trust and excitement about the period of time where the play becomes interpreted by artists. And that's very rare to find. So there was like just the technical opportunity of being able to really make something of my own out of it, and to be invited to do that, which I think is true collaboration. But thematically, you know, I began, you know, not the beginning of 2020, but certainly early in 2020, I was, like a lot of people, having a really fraught relationship with time and with the minutiae of a day, because that's all that could fill a day because we were in lockdown. And I think I, you know, in March, April, May, June, I was, yeah, in a real fraught place with that. But then by the time the script reached me in November of 2020, and having gone through this crazy experience, I had, in order to survive that, and then I think in a kind of glorious discovery, I realized that there was this liberation in the minutiae of the day, that I could sort of obsess on my coffee routine this morning. I get to have this cup of coffee in the sunshine. I get to go on a walk with my dad. You know, that started to consume me in a new way. And I liked that the script afforded me a chance to highlight that discovery through Fran. Because I think she begins in a similar place of feeling fraught in her relationship to time and her place and her day. And by the end, there's this sort of celebration of those things.
Yeah.
And understanding that that's what fills us. And so I just really responded to that arc very much.
Well, it's really lovely to hear you talk about that, because one of the most wonderfully cinematic moments in the film is where you sort of use cinema's capacity for time in the way that only cinema can do, really, which is in the middle of the film, or towards the end of the film, but in the middle of the story, you know, there's a kind of lost weekend where time just becomes radically different to the rest of the film, and then we're brought back into the present moment, you know. And that felt like a real encapsulation of, okay, I mean, this is a, it sort of brought that thesis in, like, this is about time and how we experience it in the slowness of the day, or the speed of a new relationship, and all the ways that time changes constantly. It's not a constant thing. It's not something that is always the same in terms of how we engage with it.
Oh, thank you for saying that. Yeah, I would say that time is probably my greatest concern as an artist. I find it's the main, like, métier in anything that I do. And this one posed a very interesting conversation about time. I think each time I try to deal with that theme, I try to deal with it in a different way. And I like the way you described that. I think whether consciously or unconsciously, yeah, that was definitely a way that we conceived of it.
So when did you learn about the short film, and what's your relationship to it? Because I was really interested in how it captures a lot of the tone and the feeling of the short. You know, it's kind of in dialogue with it as the starting point visually and cinematically for this play. And you seem to really respect and honor it in how you shot the film, how you conceived of the use of space and everything. You're smiling. So you're about to tell me you've never seen the short, and I'm just sort of... It's just a coincidence.
As you guessed. I've never seen it.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not because I didn't want to. I made a very quick, immediate calculation that, based completely on artistic ethics and integrity, which was, there is absolutely no way that I can stand in front of the film that I made and feel confident that all the choices that I'm saying are mine on the screen. I had a feeling like I can't say that. I can't own that statement. If in the back of my mind, while I was making the film, I had this other film to crib from.
Yeah.
That I wanted to have the absolute assurance in myself that I know that the choices I made were mine, and that at no point would there be some sort of ethical breach in those statements. And then, you know, by abstaining... And then time passes, and then, like, after now it's made, it sort of feels like, well, I don't know. I mean, I guess I could watch it in time. I don't know why I haven't at this point, but I don't know. I'm lazy. I'm a lazy old gal. That's why.
Amazing. Well, that's really interesting, because I think, yeah, it speaks to, as a screenwriter myself and sort of someone who teaches screenwriting, I think it speaks to how you can just tap into something that's quite universal in terms of a sort of cinematic representation, because the feeling is just very, very shared, and which means that I think that the artistic response from the short filmmakers and yourself is is that it's on the page, and you know, the same things you want to draw out in terms of how you represent it. I think that's really fascinating.
I think that is really fascinating. And I think it actually just speaks to the importance of that sort of source material, that the page is this really fertile space of translation and communication to a bevy of artists that are going to create something, and the responsibility of the page. I think that that's really exciting. That you can see that kind of shared DNA. It sort of elevates the role of the script in the process as a result.
Amazing. So it's set in the Pacific Northwest, that's right, isn't it?
Mm-hmm, on the coast of Oregon.
Yeah. I wanted to sort of talk a bit about that, because one of the things I'm really interested in is regionality and place. And I think it's quite similar in the States and in the UK, in terms of we often have like a shorthand one film or one filmmaker for a place, you know. Like in the UK, you know, Shane Meadows is associated with Nottingham, and that's it for Nottingham. It's a big city, but it gets one filmmaker. And I think and there seems to have been a narrative in the last 20 years that Kelly Reichardt is the Pacific Northwest chronicler, you know, and she's amazing.
Yes.
And I think there's resonances with her work in your work, but it was so nice to see the place represented in a way that was fresh. Because it's a different take on the place that we've seen because of that kind of shorthand. So I wondered, like, yeah, your thoughts on the relevance of the resonances of place in the film, because I think that for me it's like it felt like a place where ennui makes sense. And I don't mean that as a denigration on the place at all, but just in terms of landscape and proximity to different things, it felt very logical that kind of feeling could build up in that locale. And as someone who's, like you said, born in the South and lives in New York, I think place is probably something you consider in terms of how you feel in different places and what different places make you feel.
Yeah, there's sort of two answers to touch on to your question. One is the philosophy of place in one's process, and then as it relates specifically to this piece of work. And my philosophy of place and my process is central. It's a character as much as anything else. And setting is crucial to any kind of art making, particularly if it's story related. Up until sometimes I think about dying, all of the films I'd made were Southern, because that's what I know. And that's a world in which I met a lot of the artists I continue to work with, like I did on this one, my editor, my cinematographer, my composer. Not only do I have that philosophy of how it affects storytelling and obviously how I've harvested that previously, but also in terms of how I build a film, place is sort of my doorway into the film, even if it is a place I know really well, like the South. And I say the South is very grand. I mean, to those who are from the American South who might be listening to this, I mean specifically like Kentucky, Tennessee, Appalachia area.
Yeah.
So, you know, even though I'm from there, if I am facing a film, one of the first things I do is I go there where the film is to be, and I live in the film. I often find all my own locations. A lot of spaces we go to are filled with people I find or meet there as I spend time there. A lot of the relationships to the place that might render the place on screen in the most authentic way is from that time. And I think that's crucial. I don't think that one can be a tourist when they're capturing place. It's a different perspective. Maybe if you're making a film about being a stranger in a strange land, the tourist perspective is crucial. But most of the stories I tell, the people are from there. So it doesn't make sense. So that already was baked into me and how I approach things. The first conversation I had with Alex when we knew we were making the film, she was like, okay, when can you get on a plane? Because I know that's all you really want to do is to get there. And I was like, tomorrow, how about? But when choosing Oregon, which was a choice that Alex and I talked about quite a bit early on, a lot of factors went into it. The script definitely stipulated that it needed to be a coastal area where crustaceans could be farmed and fished. So that's very limited in where that could be in the States. So of those choices, I wanted to go to the West. And I think to answer your question about the natural ennui, I don't think it's a denigration. I think it's actually just what the West is. The West is a mythic place in which the individual is positioned against the expanse of possibility, the possibility of self-creation and the possibility of self-annihilation. That is how it exists, I think, in the imagination of not only Americans, but I think cineasts, anyone who watches that world on screen. So to play with these ideas, the West seemed like the correct zone to tell a story that is inherently romantic, sweeping, seductive, and about how the mind can create a reality. Because I think the mind created the reality that one could go West and invent whatever it is that the people who went West thought they could manifest in their destiny. And not from a place of glorification, but from a place of that drove people to a lot of things. And while this is in a very sort of lowercase, minor key, Fran is sort of inventing so much in her mind to believe in. And I think the West implements that visually, energetically, and to capture that in the film felt right.
Yeah. I think that's really beautifully put. I think that kind of, the duality of the realization and the annihilation of, you know, like manifest destiny as an overarching idea. But then in this character who is, kind of really struggling with who they are, and not wanting to be who they are. You know, I think you talk about the romantic element of it, and it is a very romantic film, but it was really striking that it was about the specificity, or at least for me in terms of my engagement with it, the specificity of being seen, you know? That's felt like that she just wants to be, like we all do, she wants to be seen, but she's terrified of being seen, that which is such a human thing. But you very rarely see it as the central tension of a romantic relationship in such a way as this.
Oh, I like hearing that. Yeah. I think that that's a ubiquitous and universal concern, but it's such an internal concern that, you know, I can understand why that might not be an obvious approach for plotting a story. But thankfully, this film wasn't necessarily about sort of major strokes of narrative plot. It was about, it's very much about a character who's, the broad strokes are within.
Yeah.
Have these sort of fantastical images that normally you would have such scenes in an externalized narrative way, but this isn't an internalized narrative way, which is really cool and exciting to get to conceive of and build with my team. And I think also, I think one deviation I might have made from the script, I think the script was much more overtly about romance with a capital R. And I was determined to not do that. I felt that what she was contending with was more important to focus on, or more interesting for me to focus on. And I liked the idea of lifting up the perspectives and the idiosyncrasies of those around her to put them under as much sort of the gaze as possible, to have others sort of like, who, you know, this idea of the public self versus the private self and the people we are in public and all the things that make us these strange little animals in the world, and to celebrate that. That seemed interesting to me. That seemed also to integrate with her own narrative. And I liked the idea also of someone confusing her feelings of being seen into romance. Because I actually don't think that her and Robert are having a romance at all. I think, and that's what's so exciting to me about what we did with the film. And to end the film in the way that we did, to choose to go that direction, was really exciting to me, because I felt that felt more elemental and human, and it didn't reduce all the emotions to only being about romance, that that to be, like you said, to be seen could be the central concern of her life.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear you talk about that, because that one of the films that it reminded me of in that sense was one of my favorite films, which is Punch Drunk Love. You know, the use of music particularly is very, you know, kind of very in dialogue with, because of the just the sheer lushness of this kind of classic Hollywood musical score with these really kind of internally tormented characters, or at least one central character, which I've always loved about Punch Drunk Love. And, you know, that external, the internal is so key there. And it's I was going to come back to that because there was something about the external versus the internal, and I can't remember it. Oh no, I've lost my train of thought.
It's certainly something we talked a lot about.
That was So let's talk about that, because I have remembered the point I was going to make.
Okay.
Go for it. So did you talk about that film particularly, or?
Oh, we talked about Punch Drunk Love. Yes, I talk about it all the time for like everything I do,
because it's a masterpiece. Because it's just a stone cold masterpiece.
It's sort of like unbelievable. Well. And I love that the film is so aware it's a film. And I think that was something else we talked a lot about. It was like, okay, for these visions to feel like we are living inside this person's mind, this is a first-person narrative. So at some level, we're sort of like, we're not living in naturalism. This isn't naturalism or realism. So like, let's indulge ourselves a bit here and be intentional from the place of craft, so that we're kind of underpinning that through craft. But then we tried, so we had this very self-conscious inner, you know, first-person narrative, but then we tried to frame it and score it from a very old Hollywood kind of way, because, you know, I think something that Punch Drunk was doing was something that was sort of like using a sort of determinedly 21st century idea of itself. We kind of went backwards because it felt more appropriate to Fran. She felt like a bit of an heirloom person, you know, a thing that's in the present that sort of is reminiscent of the past. And the place, Astoria, Oregon, felt that way to me when I scouted it. And so the film started to take on that same idea. So we also looked at, like, you know, Breakfast at Tiffany's, and we looked at Sabrina, and all kinds of old Billy Wilder films. And then we also looked at Patterson by Jim Jarmusch. That was another one that we looked at in terms of sort of aware, like self-awareness that it's a film, and to lean into the meditative qualities of the craft that it could afford you when you're pushing the experience into the internal space of your character as opposed to the external. So those were some of the things that we looked at, and we were very conscious of how those films would allow us to use and indulge in craft to underpin this idea of the external and the internal, and pushing the nerve inside a person and exploring it from the inside of a person.
Yeah, there's so much there I wanna dig into. Patterson particularly, because again, another of my favorite films. And this was, literally the notes that I made were like about the gentleness and the quietness of it, which just makes it so profound. You know, almost, I mean, very Patterson, very Ozu, very Simon Liang, you know, let's spend time in the experience of another person and feel it and feel the experience.
It felt radical in this day and age for us to have the camera set up and to watch Fran Chu.
Yeah.
It felt radical to watch someone wait for her dinner to warm up. And it felt radical to just pay attention to someone making her coffee at the Keurig. It felt absolutely radical to do that. And that felt cool.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. There's so few American filmmakers doing that. Like, there's obviously Patterson does it beautifully. The only other one I could think of that felt very close to you was Tyler Teomina's work, Ham on Rye and Happer's Comet, you know, which again is just this, let's have time and empathy for our characters and see them being on screen. And I think that is cinema. Like, seeing people be on screen is cinema. Like, that's what I want.
That's why we turned the film cameras on, right? They were you know, they turned the film cameras on. The first thing they wanted to do was just to watch people, you know, the kiss. They're sitting there canoodling, talking. We don't know what they're saying to each other. Maybe they will, they won't. Yeah. I don't know what's possible between these two people. And we're watching two people behave, you know. But I also think, you know, the other person that I pay a lot of attention to all the time and that I haven't mentioned yet, but I think was the, for me, the North Star for putting this film together and understanding this film was Buster Keaton. Buster Keaton, you know, the true godfather of cinema. And certainly my North Star, I think, in terms of taste and timing. And even he himself, in his early cinematic outings, you know, there's a sort of trope that there's this sort of like the sped up camera of the silent era, da, da. But he actually has this wonderful grace to his films. He allows us to sit and watch people think and to do, and he can make a glorious moment of surprise out of inertia sometimes. You know, he has a whole sequence in which a character goes to sleep and then we descend into his mind and we watch him imagine himself. And it's incredible. So I crib from Buster Keaton probably the most, historically speaking and currently. And I think his sense of comedy and all of that, I find incredibly inspiring and exciting and grounding. And so it's not even like a contemporary concern. I think this is a historical concern of cinema.
Because it's that blend of comedy and pathos in the stillness of a human face up against the speed of everything else. And Daisy's performance is so still in the face, you know, like it's, you feel the mask of, because obviously we're allowed in, like just the weight of trying to hold it all in when you don't know what it is you're trying to let out, you know.
Right. And we tried very hard it was very important to me that the first time we ever see her is actually an imagined version of herself, is a vision version of herself.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we cut to her in naturalism, because I wanted from the beginning there to be this dramatic irony that we get to share only with her and know with her as she moves through her day, but that it is a mask, that there is this profundity within that we know exists and others could know, and if only she could just, you know, break through. And so it was so important that the first sequence really introduces that idea from the beginning. So we understand that tension between the external and the internal.
Yeah, and it kind of makes a mockery of that idea that cinema can't do interiority like a novel. It's like, come on. Of course it can.
Well, that's a limited idea. I think that's also probably, I would then ask a person who houses that opinion, I would then ask them to talk to me about what they've seen.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think that, and not from a defensive place, but from a place of, I just think that I would imagine that kind of person just hasn't seen enough.
Generally the case, I think, when I find.
Yeah.
Sadly.
Cool.
There's a couple of other things I wanted to touch on. One is, you mentioned Billy Wilder, because a film that it reminded me of was The Apartment, which is my favorite film of all time. You know, just in terms of like the impact of work on life and that kind of office dynamic, I think was very much a dialogue. And the external, the internal thing was, when I was watching it, I was like, oh, this is like Harold and Maude if Harold imagined everything rather than living it out.
That's brilliant. Oh, I like that. That's great. That's great. And I'm glad you brought up The Apartment. I had mentioned some Billy Wilder films, and that was definitely one that I should have named, but certainly was included in our thinking. There's definitely a lot of public and private there, and the way that there was this beautiful formalism to how he captured the look of the office, but everything within it was sort of performed at the time, I think, with a lot of contemporary attitudes. And so in a similar way, we wanted a very composed, intentional framing, but we wanted what was seen within the camera, a scene within those frames, to be sort of determinedly contemporary, you know, to talk about like HDMI cables and I don't know, like which I think, like, you know, and to get away from all the, like, even just from the sort of thematics of it all, it's like the other thing that I wanted, like, this is what people talk about, this is what people do. You know, this is what we do every day. And I just wanted to pay attention to it.
Yeah.
Like the amount of time that I can sit and like bitch with my editor about like well, I can't hear the sound right from the TV that we're working from anymore because that thing doesn't connect to the Samsung. And if, oh, because that product isn't, I'm like, well, let's go to Amazon. Like, we can't do this. We'll just get annoyed about like the sound quality because the wrong cable, you know, and that's life. Or just, you know, like obsessing about a cruise ship that's outside your window. And you're just like, that stuff makes me laugh.
Well, it's true, isn't it? Because when you take a step back from it, you're like, well, it's compared to the world's problems. But when you're in the moment, it's hard to take that step because that is the stuff of life, isn't it? It's the day to day. It's the increments of experience, you know.
I think it can inspire the same level of sweeping emotion and thought that would make someone imagine the things that Fran imagines as she does. You know, we can be inspired by really mundane things to feel really extraordinary levels of emotion. Because that's our lives. And I did want to touch, you'd brought up the score, and I'd meant to say something about that as it relates to some of the classical cinema that we'd watched. And score was, you know, I love score, like true film score, as opposed to like noise beds. I like score to be composed and designed and to be a character in the film as well. And so does Dabney Morris, my composer. And we worked together very closely. And, you know, he was very aware through Dustin and Ryan that we were going to this sort of old Hollywood idea of some of the construction of the film. And so he knew, okay, like composing wise, like in terms of references, that might stick around the Mancinis of the world and the Nelson Riddles of the world. And he kind of had that on the back burner. And he was he's always privy to these conversations about what we just discussed, the thematics, the character, the way in which we're going to experience the film. And so he knew, okay, we're going to have these turns into deep romance, and but it's going to be counterpoised against this sort of deep mundanity. So how does the score play into that? And then the other ingredient that went into our contemplation of it was the feature script had wall-to-wall voiceover written into it. And I decided early on to not use it. And Daisy, I didn't want to impose that necessarily on Daisy. I wanted to be open. But then she indicated she wanted to use it as stage direction on set. And I was like, okay, I think we can pull this off then because everyone feels like they want to just do the thing. And maybe we can construct something and capture something that wouldn't need the voiceover. So Dabney and I talked a bit about how the score, I don't think we didn't articulate it this way necessarily, but it, looking back, I think we were discussing the score in such a way that it would be that internal monologue. It would be that internal conversation that the voiceover might have been achieving on the page. And we're like, okay, how do we not lose some of that internality? And the score became that. Score became her inner thought and life and feeling. And, you know, and then we settled on the instrumentations and the ideas because I was listening to a lot of Hawaiian ballads in the 1950s. When I was scouting, and I told Dabney that, and because this is how we, you know, I just feed him in something like that. And he comes back to me with this Mancini album called Mr. Lucky Goes Latin. And it's like, I think we should really look at this album, particularly this song, Lujon. And I was like, okay. And it's exactly the right tenor and idiosyncrasy and seduction and exotica. So that became a kind of Rosetta Stone for how to construct the score from there. So that's the story of the music.
Great, thank you. Yeah, fantastic. And it's this is the last question actually. In terms of it goes back to that thing you said before, which is it's a very cinematic piece of work. You know, it's happy to let you know that it's a film. It's happy to keep you aware that it's a film. And I've become obsessed with this on the podcast in the last year or so in terms of thinking about this idea of cinema as something which is aware of itself and happy to be aware of itself and kind of celebrating its form, you know.
Yes.
So it was interesting that movies play such a central role in the film as a kind of thematic and content point where it felt like you're kind of working through your relationship to cinema, you know, through the characters and how they feel about it, but also kind of writing this love letter to why movies matter at a time of crisis where, well, it's always a time of crisis, but almost a kind of an increased crisis from the incursion of the televisual and the idea that everything has to be about the thing that's very didactic rather than an aesthetic, emotional, sort of tactile experience where those things come in through the natural processes of filmmaking. So, yeah, just, you know, what's your relationship to the film aspects of the film as a way to sort of send us off?
Yeah. Well, in terms of, you know, not being didactic, I think that that's just taste. So that's always going to be in my work. I find verbalized exposition to be poison. You might as well put me out. There's that. I've walked out of theaters because of it. So there's that. But in terms of, like, okay, so there's two things I'll say. One, we knew that they were going to go on this movie date. And in the script, there's a lot made of their conversation in the movie theater before seeing the film. And I wanted the feeling of the film to be still from, to be totally from her perspective and how it feels. It's sort of like this arrival and he goes off to get his thing and she's in her head and it pushes the camera to around her and or she moves and it feels like the camera's moving even though it's not. And, but we're with her, we're so with her, this anticipation of, okay, I'm going to go do this thing with this guy. And we've talked a lot about that sequence. That was a big conversation between me, Dustin, and Ryan of like, how is it about the feeling of how expectation and how movies play into what we expect from experiences?
Yeah.
And that she's going to the movie and we see people going to the movies and movies and we know that that's a thing and this, and then things happen and then you get the drink and then the thing happens. And like, we wanted to kind of consciously play into this moment in most romantic stories in cinema and then try to act against it. How do we undercut it? How do we consciously lean into the things that our film allow us to comment on that or talk about that? So this is a person who builds things up in her mind and then the world never matches it and then she just feels depressed. Okay, so then the sweep, she goes in, she's in her head, and then we send the audience off to have their movie experience while they're having theirs. So we cut to images in the town because we were like, let's let them watch a movie for a minute while they're watching a movie and let the score play. Like, we're connected to her still, even though we're not watching her watch a movie. Yeah. Because we can be feeling what Fran could be feeling because of the score. And then we cut to her in the bathroom. And we're like, is the film in? Oh, no, we hear the movie. So she's left the cinema. She's just standing there. She's not going straight back. Is she going to leave? What's she going to do in this situation? It's, you know, that it's disrupting our expectations of how the movie scene goes. And then she comes out and we're like, did she leave? Is the movie still going on inside? Oh, no, here he comes. Okay. Oh, and then they're going to get something to eat. Okay, I guess she did sit through it. And then they keep going to the diner and it's like, well, how's this going to land? How's this plane going to land? I don't know. This isn't really going the way it's supposed to go. And then, did you like it? No, I don't. That was terrible. And yet it's still kind of in this romantic look and you're like, oh. So we were just kind of consciously playing against what that sequence is supposed to do in these movies and how and what we cut to, because like we invented the bathroom shot because we were like, I think we gotta see her thinking. We have to be tracking what's going on inside of her and not just people watching movies. I wonder if they're gonna kiss. What's gonna happen? You know, like instead it's what's going on inside of her.
Yeah.
He's eating popcorn and how I feel about that. And we're gonna watch this movie and it feels like this. And I'm gonna go to the bathroom and then I don't really know if I want to go. He wants to go where? And like, how do we make that cinematic? The other thing I'll say about movies in the film is this is a story of a person who their fear of themselves in the world, not knowing how they can be in the world, forces them inside of their mind to a very rich internal space. And she takes up residence in there because it is so much more lush and exciting and fulfilling than what she can experience outside of herself. And that is me. I think that's a lot of us that make films.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I got through being a person who didn't know how to be in the world, was the place that movies could take me. And I think there is this sort of meta concern to the film from the beginning, because I think we're making a film which is about an imaginative space, about a person who exists in an imaginative space. So if you're not going to, you know, be meta in your craft, then you're kind of, then you're pretending that's not there.
Yeah.
And I that just didn't seem to make a lot of sense.
Yeah, because that imagination is a cinematic space, and, you know, you've rendered it, you've used cinema and all the beautiful tools of cinema to render it cinematically. It's a really beautiful film. And I loved watching it, and I've loved talking to you about it. So thank you so much for coming on today.
It's my pleasure. I knew from your past episodes that I was promised a real cinematic conversation. So I was really excited for this.
Well, I hope it's...
I don't get a lot of that.
Okay. Well, I hope it's been a good experience in that sense.
Oh, yes.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And yeah, good luck with the film and whatever's next.
Thank you. Same to you.
Yeah, thanks to Rachel for that conversation. I had a really, really great time. I really love this film, and I hope that people go out to see it wherever it's playing. I did want to sort of end with a little note about the short film and that part of the conversation. It's funny because I was so sure that she would have seen the short film that I talked about, the one that I use in teaching, because there's such a close relationship between it visually and sort of in terms of tone. And I completely believe that she hadn't seen it. And I just thought it was so fascinating that she came to such a similar place of representing the story and the characters and the feel of the film in, and I'm not saying it's derivative, and I think it's very much Rachel's own take on it. But it felt like it was in dialogue in a way, which is really fascinating to hear that it was not. And it's almost a kind of universal unspoken dialogue that it has with the short. I really love the short because it feels cinematic. It feels like it's something that works really well in the short form. And I'm always interested when I see a feature come out of a short, because I love short films. And I think often the best short films are the ones that feel like they should only be shorts. And I don't necessarily feel that way about Sometimes I Think About Dying, but I was really curious to see what they would do that would make it a kind of feature that stood on its own terms when the short feels so enigmatic and kind of, yeah, tactile. And to see that they did such a, what I think is a great job in terms of capturing that, but also adding layers of kind of depth and nuance and complexity and sort of cinematic rendering, that really sort of take it into new and different places, was just really fascinating. I'm including a link to the film in the show notes, the short film. I suggest everyone checks it out. And I think you should do what the filmmakers did here, which is watch it after you've seen the feature rather than before. But it's there for you when you've seen the feature to check out the short film as well. And see if I'm just making it all up. See if it's all in my own head that there is a kind of really symbiotic relationship between the two. But yeah, I'll still keep... teaching it in my short film screenwriting classes, but it'll be different now that I know that this feature exists, and that, yeah, I think it'll really help actually in terms of emboldening what I say to students, which is actually, you know, if you write it a certain way, then the response is going to be within a spectrum. You know, it's not going to be like open to full weird, strange, disparate interpretations. It's going to capture something in words that the filmmakers will translate into images that are not always that far apart, depending on the different creative people that are doing it. And that's really good screenwriting for me, where you can tap into something where there's a kind of shared response in terms of how to represent those words in images and sounds. So yeah, thanks to Rachel for the conversation. I hope you see the film. I'll be back in a couple of weeks with an old school episode where I'm taping a live event with good friend of the podcast, Mark Jenkins. So watch out for a new episode in a couple of weeks with a film that Mark's picked that we're going to be screening on Monday down at the Newlyn Film House. So yeah, if you are around Cornwall on Monday the 15th and want to come down to Newlyn and watch me and Mark talk about a film for the podcast, I won't give it away, so you can find out what it is online. Or if you're not in Newlyn, you'll find out when the episode drops. But yeah, that's going to be a fun episode to do. And yeah, I hope to catch you in a couple of weeks for that. But in the meantime, thank you very much for, again, hanging out with The Cinematologist. This has been The Cinematologist Podcast. Thanks for listening.